From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Some novelists have strong opinions.
We have to continue to develop better radical solidarities. We have to continue to be critical-minded, and we have to continue to fight injustice everywhere and fight this sort of stream, you know, this kind of vomitous stream of lies that our political, economic, and social elites attempt to throw onto us.
That's Dominican-American author Juno Diaz. We'll talk with him later this hour. But we want your thoughts. Is it necessary for writers, actors, and other celebrities to get involved in politics? Do they play a critical role, or should they keep their thoughts to themselves? Give us a call and leave us your thoughts at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Just remember, we might feature your comments on the show. A significant number of safety officers at Georgia schools were terminated from law enforcement jobs or investigated for a number of reasons. That includes poor performance, lying to superiors, sexual misconduct, and inappropriate use of force. In many cases, an officer is forced to leave a police department and then takes a job in the school system instead. This emerged after an investigation this past summer by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I talked about the findings of that investigation with AJC reporter Brad Schrade.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get on to this story?
Well, we were simply looking at POST data, which POST is the state police certification agency, and we were sort of combing through that, looking, just examining it to see what might be there. And one of the things that jumped out was the number of school police officers that had prior problems in their past, either been terminated or investigated by POST. And what we found was that there are about 31 police agencies in Georgia that are attached to a school, you know, K through 12 school system. And the rate of officers who had been terminated was about twice as likely, twice as many percentage-wise at school police agencies versus the general police population, which just sort of struck us as, huh, what's going on there? That seems like an interesting question because it seems sort of counterintuitive.
Right. You'd think that the schools would be the ones where you want the safest, most patient, most...
Exactly.
Right.
And so we started probing into that just to sort of look at what was going on. And there were some police agencies that here in the metro area, particularly that... we found one, Clayton County, about one in five of their officers had been fired. And that's a relatively, from a previous position.
Right, that's a huge number.
Yeah, it struck us just, and we were trying to, then we started sort of looking at, you know, what is a school resource officer? What do they do? What is the environment they're in? And, you know, it's a very intimate police setting. I mean, they're seeing the same 2,000 kids or 1,000 kids every day. Some of these kids are, you know, as teenagers will do, will challenge you. We came across one case of an officer down in Albany who had been, he had been fired from a previous job for some questions about honesty at a regular police force. And then he got on at the Daugherty County School District and, what happened next was there was a kid who was a discipline problem who kind of was challenging him and kind of taunting him in the halls. And it was captured on police video of this officer going up behind the kid and tackling him and then just punching him and say, you're gonna learn some respect.
Yeah, that very video went viral.
A very human sort of response, but not something that you could do as a police officer.
Give me the range of reasons why these officers may have been fired from the police department. What's the best and worst reason?
Well, I mean, there's things just like you're just not a good employee. You know,
you're late all the time.
Yeah, you're just not a good employee versus, you know, excessive force, some sexual misconduct. I mean, various, you know, some pretty serious things as well.
That makes it more troubling, though, if they're that serious. I mean, as a parent, I wouldn't want a police officer that was accused of or found to be guilty of sexual misconduct than policing at a high school.
Yeah, or excessive force, for
right,
example.
Exactly. But are there standards? Now, we're talking about K through 12. We're not talking about colleges and universities.
Yes, exactly.
Are there standards? What are the minimum qualifications for someone to become an officer in a K through 12 school?
In Georgia, you simply need your post certification legally to be a police officer in a school. Now, there are some school systems, for example, Gwinnett County has, I believe, the largest police force. Gwinnett County School is the largest school force. We talked to the chief there. He said, look, we don't hire anybody who's had a post investigation or been fired from a previous job. So they have a standing policy in Gwinnett schools that they're not going to hire somebody that's been fired from a previous job. The chief told us, hey, look, it's just too risky for us to take a chance on putting an officer in a school around children that might have questions. Plus, he said, we have enough applicants to, good applicants that we don't need to hire. Now, for example, in Clayton County, they sort of were this. The police business was sort of thrust on them a few years ago when previously the sheriff's department had sort of had deputies in the school system, and suddenly the sheriff's department said, look, we're not going to do this anymore. And Clayton County sort of had to stand up a police department within a matter of months, and they had to hire, you know, a bunch of officers at once. And we talked to the chief there who stood up the department. He said, look, we think we hired good officers, but there were some officers that had previous problems.
Clayton County is just south of Atlanta. The county seat there is Jonesboro, I think. And to make sure that everyone is staying with us, when we mention POST, that's a state of Georgia certification. It stands for Peace Officer Standards and Training Council, and that's how you become certified to become an officer of any official type.
Yes, and they have to undergo training at POST, but there's a new movement. There was a new law passed this session in the Georgia legislature that is going to set up some standards for school resource officers. There was a sense that, look, there needs to be some specialized training for these folks. There needs to be we need to make sure that these officers that were going into schools have the kind of required training that's necessary to deal with the type of policing that they're dealing with in a school system.
And that was in response to not just that video from Albany, but there have been a number of videos of safety officers at schools around the country using what looks like excessive force on young children. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with AJC reporter Brad Schrade. You can read this investigation at the AJC into schools, Georgia school officers. And the result of this investigation is that 12% of those officers who serve in Georgia's elementary, middle, and high schools were terminated or investigated for offenses when they belonged to a police department. This is separate, of course, from people who may have had trouble in other jobs. We have no idea about those. We only know about those who previously worked at a police department, correct?
Yes, and these are police departments in Georgia. We based most of our reporting was on POST data, and POST does collect if you look at an officer's POST record, it will say they've been terminated from a previous job.
Wait, but that means that, as we have seen in other cases, police officers who are fired in one state will sometimes move to another state to get a job there, and you wouldn't have found those.
No, we wouldn't. We wouldn't know that based on the investigation we did. We looked at POST data. One other point, just about the different type of policing in schools and in the regular street. There's part of this legislation also. What was driving it? There is a kind of movement afoot or a discussion in education circles that, hey, look, we've got these police forces. Are we getting kids, records? Are we arresting many kids?
The school-to-prison pipeline.
Yeah, are they building a record when some of these issues maybe shouldn't be arrests or police issues, but should be disciplinary issues. So there's also a question when a police department's operating in a school system, are they supplanting what would normally be the disciplinary path for more of a law enforcement path? So there's also that sort of questions when you have these police in in a school system.
So another question for me, and we have a couple minutes left here, and you may not have the answer to this, yes, is what does it take to remove, how bad does the offense have to be, short of jail or prison time, for an officer to no longer be an officer of any type anymore? Do you know what I'm saying? Because we keep seeing these second chances, third chances, well, they just move to a different kind of policing or another state. Is there a mechanism by which somebody is just...
Well, if you're in jail, you can't be
obviously
a police officer.
But if you have a record, I would assume.
In Georgia, if you lose your post certification, you cannot work as a police officer in Georgia. Some individual department, a lot of it is, though, if you have your post certification, a lot of it comes down to what the local police agency is willing to tolerate, how many applicants they have for a job, what their pay is. I mean, a lot of it comes down to local sort of policies. As far as school systems, it really comes down to what that school system, you know, what the leadership of that school system will tolerate in their police force. But if you have your post certification in Georgia, you can work as a police officer if somebody will hire you. Now, post looks very askant at dishonesty, at, for example, the excessive force down in the case in Albany. That
but
officer lost his certificate, but he's lost his certification
now
since that.
That's Brad Schrade. He's a reporter for the AJC. You can find his story about campus cops. It's linked at our Facebook page. Brad, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to take a moment to pay tribute to one of Georgia's culinary greats. Alfreda Lockett has died. She ran Meemaw's restaurant in Macon, where she was also executive chef. GPB's Josephine Bennett visited Lockett at Meemaw's earlier this year.
We do the collards here. We do the field peas, the lima beans, cabbages.
Alfreda Lockett grew up cooking and opened Meemaw's in 2011 in an unassuming block building on Mumford Road. Her family recipes have been passed down through the generations.
As a child going to visit my grandmother, I remember the smells, the aromas, the smoke coming out the chimney. And when I would go to the country, those things stuck with me because people were always cooking.
And while they were cooking, she was watching and learning. After retiring from Bell South, she attended culinary school and opened Meemaw's in the neighborhood where she grew up.
People cooked. They didn't eat out. They didn't have the monies to eat out as much. So I wanted to bring something back, and my husband did too, back to the community so the kids of today could share in that taste.
It's an unlikely place for a restaurant, but the neighborhood has embraced it. Word of mouth has brought diners from well outside Macon.
I have people that comes from Atlanta. I have all ethnic group. I have people that enjoy food.
That's Alfreda Lockett speaking with GPB's Josephine Bennett. Lockett was the executive chef at Meemaw's restaurant in Macon. She died this week at the age of 66. Just ahead, author Juno Diaz has some choice words for the millennial generation. But first, Athens musician Kishi Bashi returns to Georgia. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's a cliche at this point that indie artists are hard to label. But in the case of Kishi Bashi, it's really true. His first solo album creates intricate soundscapes with violin and vocal loops, and his voice often sweeps from low pitches to falsetto. Kishi Bashi is a pseudonym for Kaoru Ishibashi. This Saturday, he'll perform in his hometown of Athens, Georgia. I talked to him last year while he was on the road for his latest album, Sonderlust.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We have some clips of your music to play, and so I kind of want to do them in chronological order. So let's go back to 2011. This is the song Manchester. Oh.
wrote me a book. I hid the last page. I didn't even look. I think I locked it in a cage. Wrote a novel.
You know, I feel like a lot of people describe some of your music, especially some of this early stuff, as soundscapes, which I reject personally because it's a song and then backings. But I wonder what you start with. Do you start with the mood or the sound, or do you start with this actual just the song?
I'm a musician first, instrumentalist, so it's all music. So I kind of create, you know, I guess I do create soundscapes. I create sound and then I force a song into it. Usually, is how it works.
So, and then do the lyrics, are they the last thing?
They're always the last. So, words for me, like the words float out as kind of like instruments, you know, themselves. And then as strong words form for like the choruses, that's where I turn them into stories.
So I want to hear how your music transforms when you're actually playing mostly acoustically, and in this case, live. This is from what became a very popular Tiny Desk concert for NPR from 2012. This is I Am the Antichrist to You. Choose your playlists for each venue. How do you change it up?
You mean like a set list? I keep the same set list for the entire tour a lot of times, because I like to think of it as a play. You know, when you're like, when you take a Broadway show on the road, it's like they don't change up the story, you know. So I kind of evolve it and perfect it, and you know, and have like moments. A lot of times there'll be little differences, but for the most part, I like to keep the same set list.
That implies that you choose a set list based, and you think it's telling a story, right?
Yeah, there's an arc to it. You know, there's a lot of like, it'll start with like maybe new songs, or it'll start with things, or I'll have things to talk about, and then I'll have like a little theater. You know, there's a couple theatrical elements in it too. You know, so but I feel like I don't feel bad about repeating the same set list because there is an arc.
Right. So let's then move forward to the new album. And this is one of the bigger tracks off of it. This is Hey Big Star from the new album Sunderlust. So this one was produced by Chris Taylor of Grizzly Bear. How did his production change your sound, do you think?
I think the reason why I approached him was that he has great taste, and I needed somebody to kind of ground me in a more simple production. So I needed somebody to basically tell me that you don't need all these crazy elements that you might have added in the past.
It sounds like you felt like you needed an editor.
Yeah, that's what a producer is a lot of times.
And there's this sound. I mean, there's an element of risk to the sound in this music. Like, it's almost as though each track is just this side of spinning out of control.
Thanks.
That's a good thing, to my mind. But you call it the musical equivalent of fumes. And I wonder what you mean by that.
Oh, fumes. Okay. When I was creating the earlier, like my past two albums have been violin centric, meaning that I would compose them from the violin. But this time around, it was writing new songs, it became the musical equivalent of fumes, meaning like that there were really, it wasn't inspiring to me, so I took a totally different approach, and I composed a lot electronically and through the keyboards.
Okay, so you say it wasn't inspiring to you, and I assume you're referring to, you've said that you were sort of at an impasse before this album, and the way you describe it sounds like you were like the musician's version of writer's block?
So what was happening was that because my first two albums were pretty well received, and you know, a lot of people were kind of, I assume that a lot of my listeners were expecting a similar sound. So as I approached the compositional process and the songwriting process, I just found that I couldn't come up with anything that was interesting to myself, which is like the worst way, worst position to be in. So, because that would translate into the album. So I took a totally new approach.
And what was that breakthrough moment for you?
I think there's the kind of catharsis when I understood that the music, that this album would just be a snapshot of, you know, of my life, and it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be a continuation of my previous work. It's basically an album for an artist is just that moment in time.
And this moment in time seems to have come from a place, you called it a place of heartbreak, which it sounds like your success. Maybe, I don't want to assume anything, but maybe you weren't quite prepared for the rigors of touring or how exhausting musical success could be. Is that fair?
I mean, touring is definitely, it's a lot of it has to do with my family and just touring and my marriage, essentially. It's a difficult thing for me to even talk about, but it is like, it's definitely in there, like as far as like the lyrically, I really found an avenue to pour out my emotions into the lyrics.
And that's just kind of the line where I want to take a moment to explore, because you say it's difficult for you to talk about, and yet you're such a romantic musically, and you basically just wear your heart on your sleeve. And if you're touring, that means you're pouring these lyrics out night after night after night, city after city after city. What's the difference between that and talking about it?
Well, because, I'm a musician and not an orator, you know, so it's difficult for me to talk about like it with words, but, as far as emotion, when I'm on stage, I make my music for my listeners. So I open myself up as much as possible.
And that's not as difficult. That's less painful. Is it actually therapeutic?
It's definitely therapeutic. There's a lot of emotions, because every time I sing certain songs, I do feel there's a lot of pain involved, but you know, it's like, it's with any art, the more personal it is, the better it is.
You told our producers that your last concert was kind of low energy, and you're wondering if people were worn out from Halloween. Is that right?
But we played a show the day after Halloween, and it was definitely subdued, surprisingly.
Yeah, and your energy is so, well, for me anyway, it's hard to listen to without smiling. It's very joyful. And how does that change your performance, do you think? How does the audience's behavior or their attitude change the way you play?
If the energy is not high, then it might affect us psychologically. I'm sure musically we're all like trained musicians, you know, so I feel like it probably doesn't affect the actual show. Some of the banter might change, you know,
right,
between songs.
So, yeah. It's become more morose. Let's hear another clip from the new album. This is Say Yeah. We got about 30 seconds left. Do you feel like the writer's block has gone? Has that demon been banished?
I don't know. I kind of approach it as like a case by case basis. So you can probably ask me before I start writing for the next album.
Musician Kishibashi. He'll perform this Saturday at the 40 Watt in Athens. We'll be right back. And now let's add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are very simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists can't pick one of their own songs. Today's selections are from Andrew Shepherd, frontman for Athens band Roadkill Ghost Choir.
Daddy, please hear this song. Hey, my name is Andrew Shepherd. I play in the band called Roadkill Ghost Choir. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Two-Headed Boy Part 2 by Neutral Milk Hotel. It's just, oh man, that song, I mean, that whole record is heartbreaking and beautiful and just so heavy. That song in particular, it's just so sad. And there's like a sweetness to it, though. It's easy to listen to, but it's also has those moments of just devastating imagery. Bless the please with those wings in your spine. Love to be with a brother of mine. All these kind of lines that I wish I wrote, you know, God is a place, you'll wait for the rest of your life. It's just heartbreaking stuff. Struggle to find secret songs that you keep wrapped in boxes. I like sad music. I'm drawn to it. And that song is, yeah, I think it's a beautiful song. And it's so great because there's not a lot going on musically. It's just, you know, pretty much him and a guitar, but his vocal and the way he delivers the lyrics themselves carry it and make it like something really special. It kind of shows you that if you believe in the songs and you have a clear picture of what you want to do, you don't need a big budget and you don't need really the technical ability to play your instrument. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Crease by Thayer Serrano. So yeah, this song, it's really dark, really. I love, there's a lot of like heavy tom drum kind of stuff. And the guitar tones are always so great. How she performs and the sound of it all is just close to that spiritual kind of like, oh my God, like, oh, I feel it. You know, it's very dark, it's very pretty. It just kind of hits all the things that, you know, I really like about music and especially her music. It's just the atmosphere of this track that I think kind of captured me. Sad music, for me, just makes it easier to navigate through the hard times rather than an obscenely happy song about the glory of being alive. You know, it's like, that has its place, for sure. But yeah, I identify with more of a downer of a tune simply because that's the reality, I think, of being a human. A lot of the bands that I listen to and friends with here, there seems to be that common thread of everyone's trying to push themselves as musicians and as artists and not try to be something that they're not. Everyone's here seems to embrace kind of like their roots of being from Georgia. There's always like, you know, that southern kind of twang that runs through, like it's like a little filter.
That's Andrew Shepherd of the Athens-based band Roadkill Ghost Choir. They perform at Terminal West in Atlanta tonight at 9 p.m. If you have a song that you want to add to the playlist, we want to hear about it. Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media. You can find the entire Georgia Playlist series along with all the great music segments that we've done at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, Dominican-American novelist Juno Diaz is not afraid to speak his mind. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. It's been 10 years since author Juno Diaz published his hit novel, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. That book won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Diaz was born in the Dominican Republic and raised in New Jersey. He formerly taught at Freedom University here in Georgia. That school offers college classes to undocumented immigrants. Diaz was back in Atlanta earlier this year for a lecture at Emory University, and I caught up with him then.
There are two sides. Well, there's more than this, but certainly in terms of literature, Juno, there are two sides to your life. There's the educational portion and there's the creative portion in terms of your own writing. How different are those two jobs for you?
Well, fortunately, I have a couple of more facets, or at least vocations. But, you know, I do a lot of community work. And that itself has puts another spin on that dyad. But when I think about my creative work versus my teaching at university and at workshops, well, one of them is entirely reclusive. One of them is about wrestling heroically with one's material and one's unconscious. And the other one is really kind of a civic enterprise. Teaching is deeply embedded in our civic society. It's the kinds of teaching that I'm involved with and engaged with are linked to the best of our democratic principles about creating critical-minded, independent thinkers. And certainly there are lots of connections between being a creative person and pedagogy, but I often find them to be very, very different modalities for me. One of them is about giving as much as I can to the young people and the folks who sit in workshops or classes with me. And the other one feels very much about carving pieces of myself, and that's very different, I think.
There are authors who, I don't want to say complain, but they talk a bit about how sometimes commitments can pull you away from the writing process. In other words, the process of sort of going down into the depths of your psyche where the creative juices flow can be difficult if you're constantly being pulled out in different directions. Do you find that to be the case? Is it difficult to switch from one job to the other?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's never time. There's never time. I mean, I don't know about I don't know many people who have a pure writing life that's not interrupted by family, that's not interrupted by the daily demands of living, that's not interrupted by the fact that very few of us can live off of our work and of our writing, and therefore we have to work. Certainly there's conflicts. I mean, that's the nature of life. Being an artist is sort of trying to figure out how to make the creativity happen in between the cracks. I've been doing that my whole life, so I never knew anything different. I guess if there had been this wonderful, glorious time where I was just creative and didn't have the demands of the society or the family or paying for rent or getting food, then perhaps this would feel like a fall from heaven. But in fact, this has been sort of the baseline of my life, trying to figure out between all my other kind of commitments and responsibilities, how I can grow my fiction.
And so that makes the sacrifice of time when you give to volunteer or charitable organizations all that more valuable. So how do you choose where to put those efforts, the things that are going to take your time up or take you away from your creative work? How do you choose those?
I wish I could say that there was this very strict set of ethical criteria, but a lot of it has to do with your passion. A lot of it has to do with me, what's grabbing me at any given moment. Of course, my community is very important, the Dominican, immigrant, Caribbean, African, diasporic, you know, that kind of sort of, you know, universe to me matters deeply. But again, I've kind of been involved in the sort of community organizing or activist arena for a long time, and you just do what you can. I never feel like I do enough. It's less, you know, that I wish I had more time for writing, and more I wish I had more time to give to, you know, the marginalized communities that I'm committed to.
So you must think back to your own school experience every time you not only enter the classroom, but, you know, when you're giving a lecture like the one you'll give at Emory. What were the things that you heard from professors or visiting scholars? What were the things that actually motivated you or inspired you that worked?
Well, one thing about being an undergrad, the way I was an undergrad was, I had a full-time job while I was going to classes. So I was going to state school and doing the job thing. And, you know, that's pretty common for non-select college students. And what struck me most about, it's been over 20 years since I've been at university, getting close to 30 years. And what I think rings true to me still, what sort of, energizes me still, is the faculty members who brought a tremendous amount of passion to their material. You know, you can never forget that. That's just something of a gift when a faculty member is just really engaged and invested in their material. And then, of course, faculty members who, for me, professors, who had very strong ethical, critical commitments. And there was also the modeling of, you know, kindness and generosity and forgiveness. And you don't always see that in classrooms. But when I did see it, it was sort of like glimpsing pearls in mud. It was very impactful for me.
So then, I mean, first, can you explain what you mean by the ethical critical commitment? What does that mean in a professor?
Well, folks who, you know, have a kind of clearly stated or clearly sort of practiced sets of ethical commitments. You know, they make it clear that that they have values around thinking. They have values around acting. Professors who are like, I'm sort of not down with misogyny. I'm not down with, oppressive systems. Professors who make it clear that there's nothing ethical about xenophobia and there's nothing ethical about racism, and that there's more to life than simply accumulating money, that we have an ethical and moral dimension, which is important for us to explore and uphold. And faculty members like that, who weren't there just to do a advanced sort of vocational training, get me ready for my job, that mattered a lot. That mattered a lot. I mean, we're not only in university to be prepared for jobs. We're supposed to be in university to receive a civic and an ethical and a critical education. And, you know, these days in the neoliberal university, that's fallen by the wayside. But I still hold that that's among the most important elements of university life.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with novelist Juno Diaz, author of a number of books. I think one of the most recent was This Is How You Lose Her, an incredible short story collection. And I wondered, Juno, you know, your life is very different than when you were in college. At this point, you must meet people constantly who had a really powerful emotional reaction to your writing, whether it be one of your books or stories or whatever else they've written from you. And I wonder what that is like for you as a person, as a human being, when you're constantly meeting people who your first interaction with them is them saying, your writing changed my life. How do you handle that?
Well, fortunately, that's not a very common experience. I sort of live in the traditional real world of waiting online at the mail, at the post office, and, you know, getting cut off in the car and having to walk through the cold everywhere.
Yeah, you know, in Boston. You must get cut off in the car a lot.
Yeah, and walking through the cold, believe me. That's kind of the given. It doesn't happen a lot. And then again, when it does happen, you know, I am moved and one is grateful and one is touched that one is able to provide a kind of an artistic space for someone to explore and to feel inspired and to feel moved. I mean, that's wonderful. It's something that, you know, that keeps you to the page and keeps you to the work. But you have to understand, just for me and what my personality is, I'm always also embarrassed by that stuff. It's not my bag. I don't get a thrill out of applause. I never have. That's what made me such a lousy, you know, athlete. You got to thrill to applause if you're gonna, you know, kind of try to excel in the public space. I like writing. I like the art I do because it allows me to excel very privately. And so when that private labor, you know, intersects with the public reaction to it, I'm always sort of flummoxed. I don't know what the hell to do. Other ones of my friends, they love that stuff. I have friends of mine, when they get recognized in the street, they just beam. I'm always like, I got to tell you, man, I have friends of mine who, if they were here listening to this, they would be nodding their head. They're like, yeah, I'm always really embarrassed and abashed and I'm trying, you know, I don't know. It's just never been. Yeah, I don't know.
So that brings me back to teaching, especially since you'll be speaking at Emory, and especially because you spent a good amount of time working with Freedom University here in Georgia, that gives a post-secondary education to undocumented immigrants here. That brings me back to that question of then what do you tell students? What maybe advice could you give them that could have worked for you or helped you in your college or very near post-college years?
I have to tell you, young people spend most of their lives being inundated by old people giving them advice. It's probably the primary genre, the primary just medium, not even medium, but the genre, you know, the primary discourse. They're just kind of flooded with it. I just try to, you know, I don't give advice unless I'm asked. And what I try to do is I try to model and, you know, model what I would think is good ethical behaviors and sort of, you know, try to be super present, super committed, to go above and beyond for them, to center them in the classroom experience, that they're what really matters, they're what's really important, you know, and to show what learning and being wrong looks like. I spend a lot of time in classroom being wrong. You know, I'm not in the classroom because I know everything. I'm in the classroom because I'm a lifetime learner, and the importance of learning and what it takes to be a learner and the sort of modesty and humility and openness that is required to learn and what it takes to confront sort of disloyalty to, you know, what it takes to confront what's messed up about our society and to develop a disloyalty to our society's messed up rules. You know, this is a society that's very, very sexist. And when you get some sort of education, you know, to be a critical, ethical person means you're going to have to be disloyal to the rules of the society. And that takes courage and that takes a certain amount of spine. And, you know, it's an important thing to learn and to develop that in a collective. And that's what I try to do in the classroom, is to provide the collective opportunity to be able to learn some of these difficult skills and difficult values that are essential to being a learned moral person.
So then here we are in this time when a lot of things are changing, and the things that are changing are things that you have addressed in your writing in one way or another. Issues of immigration, issues of how you treat not just immigrants, but people who are foreign or foreign-born. Issues of sexism. Even the proposed defunding of the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities. These are all things that have changed since you won the Pulitzer Prize. What do you think is the role now for, has it changed for a creative person, either young or your age? What has that job changed at all?
Well, I mean, I always think it's, just because we have white nationalists in the White House, just because we have white supremacist fringe politics vaulting and sort of sliming their way into the mainstream, doesn't mean that these forces haven't always been present in our society. It doesn't mean that suddenly overnight, before this, there wasn't any of this stuff crushing people down. We've had to fight and organize against this type of malign politics for as long as we've been around. And I'm not just speaking about what's the role of the artist. I'm just speaking about what's the role of the ethical citizen, certainly as a person of African descent. What's the role of somebody who comes out of the history of struggle, my community. And so I think certainly when you've got fools like this in power and office, you've got to redouble your labors, but they're familiar labors. They're familiar strategies and modes of resistance. I just think that we have to do what we've always done well to continue to transform and to better the society. We have to continue to form positive collectives. We have to continue to develop better radical solidarities. We have to continue to be critical minded, and we have to continue to fight injustice everywhere and fight this sort of stream, this kind of vomitous stream of lies that our political, economic, and social elites attempt to throw onto us.
That was novelist Juno Diaz. I spoke with him in April. And that's our show for today, but we'd love to hear from you. We talked about campus cops earlier this hour. Should police who've been fired for misconduct be given a second chance on school campuses? Would you feel safe sending your child to school in that situation? You know how to reach us. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. We're at OST Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.